Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week on RealityCast, a look at how culture warriors try to take the edge off, and some state battles over who controls women's bodies. Also, an interview with Samhita from Feministine and the place of imaginary friends in the anti-choice canon. Sometimes you never know what'll take off virally. A few people not that long ago got the idea to start donating money to Planned Parenthood in Sarah Palin's name and then email their friends and suggest they do the same thing. The chain took off.
We had absolutely nothing to do with it. It was a completely grassroots movement from our supporters, and we are so excited to hear that people are writing checks to us instead of just complaining about it. They're actually doing something about it. Any donations made to Planned Parenthood in the name of someone or in honor of someone, the thank you card for those donations is sent directly to the person who was donated in honor of. In the end, Senator McCain's presidential campaign office could potentially receive hundreds of thousands of thank you notes from Planned Parenthood supporters.
The amount of money generated by this completely grassroots campaign is estimated to be over $800,000. Lisa Kachetumis for pointing me towards a brilliant Slate article by Melinda Henneberger and Dahlia Lithwick about what they call e-harmony voting, where people are more interested in validating candidates for being someone they'd like to have as friends than as someone whose policies and leadership skills fit the qualifications the voter would like to see. Voters of every stripe are guilty of this, from urban liberals who see themselves in the Obamas, to soccer moms cozying up to the Palins, to grumpy old men who think McCain is clearly the best choice. As the authors note, nowhere is this attitude more prevalent than in women who supported Hillary Clinton and can't get over their bitterness that she lost, projecting all their problems onto her candidacy. But there's another way that the personal above the political is used more and more, and it's a way to soften up the culture wars for the moderates who run far away from the ugliness that invariably springs up in the clash over how much control the government should give your puritanical neighbor over your bedroom and family life. More and more often, we're seeing culture warriors make appeals to their own personal charm or tolerance in order to convince skittish moderates that they aren't so far to the right. Mike Huckabee highlighted his sense of humor and his willingness to play some rock music. And now we have Sarah Palin contrasting her political views with her personal charm. The tactic may have reached a new level of strangeness when it was revealed that Sarah Palin, in order to convince people she's a true believer in love the sinner but hate the sin, claimed in 2006 that even though she's hostile politically to gay rights, she's got gay friends. The problem, as Dan Savage noted, is that these gay friends haven't surfaced. To highlight the absurdity of this strategy, Dan made a video offering to be Palin's gay friend.
Here's why I think I'd be a great choice for your gay friend. I write a sex advice column called Savage Love, and I talk to a lot of teenagers about sex and sexuality and responsibility and birth control. You have kids who have been apparently deprived of any sort of sex education because you're religiously opposed to it, and I could be their sort of cool gay uncle, kind of close to their parents' age, but the one that they can come to and confide in with their sex problems and come to when they need advice about birth control or abortions or men.
Other submissions immediately came in of people who were facetiously offering to help Palin moderate her image by hanging out and being her friend. This guy's was pretty damn funny.
Listen, Sarah, let's get down to brass tacks. Things have not been going so well for you lately. Just days ago, you were thought of as this lovable, feisty maverick, someone just like us. But the bloom is coming off the rose, and you need to do something pronto. I know you have some debates coming up, and girl, you need some prep. So that's where your gay best friend can come in. Listen, Sarah, you have your Bible, but I have a secret book that the straight world knows nothing about. It's given to all little gay boys as we're indoctrinated into our alternative lifestyle by the secret forces out to destroy small-town America. And that book is... The Big Gay Book of Drag Queen Insults.
But it wasn't just the guys offering. Here's another from a woman named Danielle.
I'm sorry I can't give you a video, but my camera isn't working, and hopefully you'll still be able to pick me as your gay friend. Anyway, I feel that I could fit in really well with your family. I'm about the same age as some of your kids, and I feel that I could be friends with all of you, you know, in case one of your kids wants to run for office one day, I can be their gay friend too. I can play hockey with your sons, and, you know, I can date your daughter, Bristol.
Of course, what really matters is not who your friends are, but what your policies are. I just finished reading The Nine by Jeffrey Toobin, and there is one interesting juxtaposition that shows exactly how ridiculous trotting out the gay friend gambit is. Justice Thomas is described as being very affectionate to a former clerk who is a lesbian, and he has a picture of her and her partner on his desk. This personal affection for actual gay people in his life didn't stop Thomas from dissenting on Lawrence v. Texas, which extended the basic right to have a private sex life without the threat of jail to gay people. You're seeing the same level of confusion on the political, personal aspects of choice. In Palin's personal life, there's a lot of choice to bear children going on, and she's getting praised by people who are hostile to choice, like talk radio show host Lee Rogers using Sarah Palin's supposed moral superiority to bash women who don't make choices he agrees with.
But I have a deep suspicion that the reason the liberals hate Sarah Palin is that she is a normal person, and they hate that. They just hate it. And I also believe, and of course the left-wing bloggers just went nuts when I first said this, but I still believe it, so I'll say it again. I believe that the reason a bunch of puckered butt Democrat women hate Sarah Palin is because her idea of choice was choosing not to have an abortion.
Once again, people are pretending that policy has nothing to do with this. No, there's no way that women could have political disagreements, no siree. We're all just a bunch of cats clawing at each other for personal choices. Look, contrary to the claims of anti-choicers, making the choice to carry a pregnancy to term after learning the baby will have Down syndrome isn't a de facto expression of willingness to deprive all women everywhere of choices. Palin was anti-choice before she made her choice, and would be anti-choice even if that had never happened. Michael Berube, blogging at Pandagon, mentioned the way this personal choice is getting politicized in relation to his and his wife's choice to have a child with Downs. Quote, "But guess what? Janet and I are pro-choice in theory and practice. And if you choose to have a child with Down syndrome, we'll support all the educational, medical, and vocational programs you and your child will ever need." End quote. I'd like to welcome Samita Mukhopadhyay to the program. Samita is a feminist writer and an editor at Feministine and has recently moved from San Francisco to New York on a writing sabbatical. But she's taking time out to talk to me today about the current political scene and a feminist place in it.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
The introduction of Sarah Palin to the campaign season has really reinvigorated the culture wars. But I was surprised to see the story about the rape kit funding in Wasala when she was mayor become such a huge story. How do you feel about this becoming such a big story? Is it a good thing or a bad thing for activists fighting violence against women?
I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword because I think on one level it is important to expose the story for what it is. And I think that a lot of the evidence indicates that it is what it is. You know, every attempt at kind of fact-checking and claiming that Palin didn't know about it has pretty much come up untrue. So, you know, I think it's important for us as the voting public to know about it. But I do think the kind of bigger story about the way that victims of sexual assault and rape, the way their stories get manipulated for political gain, like, I do think that while it's happening on some level, I don't think that that kind of bigger story is really That's not really the lesson, right, that's coming out of this.
I thought it was really interesting how some of the people trying to debunk the story just naturally assumed that there were probably no rape victims needing rape kits in Wasalla that year, but Alaska's rape statistics would kind of make that unlikely.
Right, exactly. And not only just the rape statistics, but specifically rape in the indigenous community, which is something that's already underreported, and there has been very little legislation. I think I've seen one op-ed in the last year that even is talking about the rate at which Native and Indigenous women are raped on reservations. So, yeah, so it's kind of like that story, which I actually did see some coverage on that on CNN, but they didn't really make that, they didn't make that leap of, you know, there's this really high kind of, there's this high risk of rape or this, like, problem, like, quantifiable evidence of sexual assault committed in Alaska, but didn't really make the connection between that and Palin's stance, which is obviously, like, an explicitly almost, like, anti-Indigenous woman's stance. It could be read that way, right? So,
did you see the story about how she couldn't talk about another court case besides Roe versus Wade?
Yeah.
Did you think that was, like, a serious gaffe, or is it just that Roe is such a litmus test case that no other cases really matter?
No, I think that it's not a priority issue for her. I think it's something that, I mean, I don't think it's just about Roe. I mean, she's consistently showing an inability, like, you know, a lack of knowledge on a different kind of different points. And I think that for the position that she's in and, you know, the potential for her to be vice president, like, she needs to be articulate in cases other than Roe v. Wade, specifically in light of how many cases are coming up state by state that are trying to overturn Roe v. Wade, but doing it with, you know, like, alternative language or, you know, doing it in these other ways. So I don't think that, you know, I honestly think, yeah, I mean, I think it is a gaffe. And I do, I mean, I do think that, you know, it just kind of shows her lack of knowledge in this issue.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of those alternative attacks on Roe coming up. We have the South Dakota ban, which is an explicit attack on Roe versus Wade. It can't be read any other way. But we also have this Colorado situation where they've got a ballot initiative to define personhood as starting when an egg is fertilized. What's your take on that?
I actually think that's an explicit ban too, or an attempt, because I think that that question was addressed with the passage of Roe v. Wade. So I don't really understand why, how that could be read any other way, because it's the kind of initial conversation of when life begins, I think was addressed, and, you know, in the initial court case. So it's, you know, it might be this kind of attempt at linguistic workaround, but it's still same issue at hand, right?
Do you think that what would happen is they'd try to get a court injunction under that to stop women from getting abortions?
Yeah. I think that's the potential threat.
So do you think that with all these different kinds of laws being passed that we're actually facing a serious threat, or are right-wingers just kind of, pardon the expression, pissing in the wind here? Do you think that they're going to get very far with these attempts?
I mean, I think that, it depends. I think it depends on a lot of factors, but I actually do think that I think a lot of these kind of, like, smaller laws that are coming, or the state-by-state laws that are coming up, are in fact an actual threat. I don't think that, you know, I don't think they're a media frenzy. I don't think they're a, talking points, you know, they're not, like, counter talking points or whatever. I think that if you look at kind of the history of what's happened state-by-state in terms of access to women, or women's access to reproductive health, there are actually cutbacks on, you know, what you can access and what's being taught in schools. And, you know, I mean, I think at every level that it's a legitimate threat. And so when we're looking at who is going to kind of be head of state, it is going to determine what, like, how the state by state legislation is going to get passed.
You've recently been living in California, so you have a little bit more upfront knowledge on the battles over gay marriage there. What's your take on Proposition 8, this attempt to ban gay marriage? What's the social support for both sides on it?
I mean, honestly, living in San Francisco, I don't even think there is support for Proposition 8. I think there might be a little bit, and it's interesting because today I wrote about Google came out publicly to urge kind of urge people to vote against Proposition 8, but most of what I've read, it's not really, there isn't really a lot of support for the proposition. I don't think it's going to pass. But, I mean, I could be wrong because I lived in San Francisco, so I don't know. But,
yeah.
I think the last time it polled, though, there was very little support for it.
Do you think that that's a sort of sea change that we can see more of? Like, are the red states going to follow, or is this just going to turn into a polarized issue?
I think it's going to be a polarized issue. I think that for California, it just ranks differently. And, well, you know what? I shouldn't actually talk more about it because I don't know a ton about it. But I don't think that red states are going to follow.
So another campaign question. Obama's campaign has brought all sorts of racial tensions to the surface. But I can't help but think that the crazy economy, the war, and other issues have maybe tamped down the race drama just a little bit. How do you think race is factoring into this campaign season?
It's so interesting because moving from California, where or moving from the Bay Area, where it's totally normal to just start talking about racism, to where I'm living now, upstate New York, which is, you know, I'm only about 90 miles away from New York City, but the lack of comfort I feel in terms of talking about race with just my neighbors or even sitting at the local coffee shop, where it's still this kind of issue where people don't really want to talk about it because either they don't have the skills to talk about it or they are racist and they don't want to kind of admit to it. And, you know, I was just telling my friend that I do think that the war and the economy have actually, at least, you know, I mean, for a while it was like front page every day, like, is it an issue of race? Is it an issue of gender? It kind of was this ongoing media theme that has quieted down a little bit. But I think in general, for the average American, this is really about race. And as much as Obama might have campaigned on some level that it's not about race, but the quality of the candidate, you know, I think that it is about race. And at the end of the day, talking to my parents and their friends and people that have lived in these more white-dominated places, you know, they don't think that he has a shot in hell because of their experience with racism in this country. So it's like, you know, I think that it may not be about race, but it, you know, on some level, or the campaign wants it to not be about race, or, you know, even Chris Rock said on Larry King, he was like, this isn't about race. I'm voting for Obama because I think he's a good candidate. Although it might be that on some level, I think the nature, pervasive nature of race is that it's so ingrained in our subconscious that it's pretty much, there's just no way that we're thinking outside of it, you know?
I had that kind of similar impression, to bring up sort of a non-election related question. When you got all that blowback, when you wrote a blog post, it was an unfeminist guilty pleasure, and you were talking about your love of hip-hop, even when it's kind of dealing in sexist themes. Do you think that mm-hmm. that was feeding into some of the ugly backlash you got on that?
Yes, I definitely think so. I think that there is an uncomfortable relationship between kind of feminism and mainstream feminist thought, and by mainstream I don't mean us, right? I don't mean people that are like constantly engaging with the issues and trying to work for an intersectional analysis, but by mainstream, by what people understand, by the people that have the audacity to claim that Palin is somehow a feminist success, right? I think there is a tension between that stance and the possibility of justifying any kind of popular black music. I do think that there's a tension in those two camps, and you're kind of seeing the pop culture version of what happened in the election coverage of Obama and Clinton. So in the pop culture version, it's, you know, girl power versus like the Dirty South rapper. And it's kind of, you know, and it's really interesting to see, you know, what's considered acceptable levels of, you know, racial dialogue in the mainstream versus what's not acceptable and what's acceptable sexism and what's not. So I definitely think that that tension frequently comes up on feminist thing because of, you know, who we reach, and I'm not really sure who that is right now, but whoever, there is this kind of very uncomfortable relationship with acknowledging any kind of success in popular black music since, you know, people have all these kind of like internalized racist ideas about black men.
So one final question. The next presidential debate is coming up. When this interview airs, it'll be the day after it. And it's on domestic policy issues. If you were able to ask the candidates just one question, what would you ask them?
I mean, I'm really interested in knowing how the budget is going to affect schools. And I think I haven't actually heard any of the candidates talk about that in a while. And and part of it is because I haven't heard them talk about it, but also because of the role in schooling in the next couple of years and the fact that No Child Left Behind is about to have all of its policies go into effect. So we're about to see drastic cutbacks in inner city schools and increasing classroom size and teacher layoffs. And, you know, and I know my teacher friends talk about it and there's, you know, some buzz on the sides, but I really think that I want to hear some clear potential policies that are going to address the fact that schools are in crisis right now, and it's directly related to budgetary concerns.
You can check out Samita's writing at feministing.com. Thanks so much for coming on to RealityCast, Samita.
Thank you.
For your semi-regular reminder that activists who claim to be pro-life aren't that at all, but mostly interested in using the law to control women's bodies and sexual and family choices. When it comes to white women, of course, the anti-choice movement stands as one. White women, especially middle-class white women, need to have more babies whether they like it or not. And they need to get married young and just generally stop agitating for equality with men. Simple, really. But when you start getting into situations involving lower-income women and women of color, it starts to get hairy. Suddenly it's not so obvious that more and more babies are desired, but the urge to control stays strong. The Colorado Personhood for Fertilized Eggs Amendment that's coming up on the ballot in 2008 is a perfect example. Activists put together a panel explaining how this maudlin concern for life doesn't extend to the lives of the most oppressed women in our society, and not to their children's lives either.
They say it isn't just about abortion. That from a panel held last night in Denver on Amendment 48, the so-called Personhood Amendment, which would define a fertilized egg as a person with legal rights. The panel included a national advocate for pregnant women and a registered midwife who opposes the ballot measure. They say it would enable the government to intervene in pregnancies in ways that are dangerous to both the pregnant woman and the child. J.C. Montoya is one of the organizers of the panel. She says similar legal precedents have led to a loss of rights for some pregnant women.
We have examples of women who have been forced by a court order to be subject to a C-section against their will.
Montoya cites one case in which both the mother and her preterm baby died after a forced C-section.
Faced with realities such as this, the anti-choice activist on hand decided to do what they always do with inconvenient facts. Deny them outright. Hey, if you can claim that the Earth is only 4,000 years old and that the birth control pill works how you say it does instead of how doctors who know what they're talking about say it does, then smaller level lies are no big deal. And that's what we get here.
Joe Riccobono with Colorado Right to Life says he's done plenty of research but hasn't been able to turn up any such cases.
Does it make any sense that a court would order someone in that case not to go through with natural childbirth? It just intuitively rings of nonsense.
Montoya says the cases are well documented, and she says they are only a few examples of the ways in which Amendment 48 goes too far.
I'm sure the extent of his research was asking a bunch of other anti-choice friends what they should tell the press if this comes up. Because it really only takes a little work to find the multitude of ways that the state looks to interfere with basic choices. And yes, so-called pro-life women get mistreated too. At the National Advocates for Pregnant Women conference, one of the speakers was against abortion rights, but she had tasted the other side of this when she was forced under court order to get a C-section. A quick Google search of forced C-section shows many other examples. It's more than that. There's risks that these laws will be used to harass women, especially women of color, for perceived misuse of their own bodies while they're pregnant. We could see an escalation of putting women in jail for using drugs while pregnant and even not taking prenatal vitamins. And there's no way white middle-class women will be monitored as much. It gets worse. Louisiana State Representative John Labruzzo has decided that the best way to address the images of misery after the non-evacuation of New Orleans in the wake of Katrina would be to bribe poor black women into not reproducing. Ever. Rachel Maddow was on it.
Telling reporters that he is researching an idea and may even introduce a bill to pay poor women to get sterilized. He says he may also want to offer money to rich people if they agree to have more babies. Labruzzo couched the idea to the New Orleans City Business Paper as a strategy for trimming the welfare rolls and for possibly ensuring better electoral hopes for conservative candidates. Quote, if your livelihood is based on government handouts, why would you ever vote for somebody who's going to lower taxes? They never would. Encouraging reproduction among preferred classes of people and discouraging reproduction among undesirable classes? That actually has a name. It's called eugenics. You will find it cross-referenced along with terms like racial hygiene in some of the better encyclopedia articles out there about the Third Reich.
Let's take bets on where Labruzzo stands on a woman's right to control her own body. Any guesses? Okay, I won't play with you. Labruzzo identifies as pro-life, which clearly means anti-choice, because he's not pro you making life if you're in the wrong socioeconomic group or race. Once again, the desire to direct and control women trumps any inclination towards life. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. This American Life League video about a memorial to mourn women's right to abortion revealed an aspect of anti-choice fantasizing I'd never considered.
American Life League is inviting you to join us in mourning and praying for our brothers, sisters, and friends whom we do not know and will never meet because they were killed before they could even take their first breath.
Is this really a powerful argument for anti-choicers? That there's all these people that would have liked them and totally been their friends if it wasn't for reproductive rights? Are they that lonely that they think that the only cure is to increase the number of people by force so that maybe someone can be their friend? I'd hate to think so, but then why is he using that argument?
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.